First last month at the site of a school shooting in South St. Louis, the teenage perpetrator left a note in his car which the police commissioner shared some of during a press conference. The note referred to a lack of friend and family connections and feelings of isolation. Our next guest has studied the psychology of school shooters and found that those feelings were common threads. And while those feelings can't in and of themselves predict a school shooting, they may offer insight in ways to prevent them. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about why school shootings happen, what they have in common? Do you work at a school? What is the administration, the staff doing to help address things like mental health and bullying and isolation among students? Call in with your thoughts, your questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Robin Kowalski is Centennial Professor in the Department of Psychology at Clemson University. Robin, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm happy to be here.
You've done a lot of research on these issues. And one thing I want to get at the start is something you're not saying we can do. The idea I think we get from TV that we can profile, that we can have a psychological set of characteristics to say, aha, this person is likely to become a school shooter. Why is that so difficult to do?
That's exactly right, because there's not a, you know, there's not a one size fits all model. And, you know, you mentioned the bullying and you mentioned the mental health issues. And, you know, the research that we found has shown that there are indeed certain, we'll call them correlates, or, you know, maybe antecedent conditions, maybe predictors. But, you know, there's a lot of children who were bullied, for example, mm-hmm. who don't, or young people who don't go on to become school shooters. There's, you know, so many young people who have mental health issues who subsequently do not go on to become school shooters. So while those factors are correlated along with some others, you know, that doesn't allow us to profile somebody just because they have those particular features as part of their, you know, their well-being.
That said, that doesn't mean there's nothing we can do. When you study people who end up becoming perpetrators in schools, and you've also looked at colleges, are there themes you see that we could say, yes, if we could treat the student body as a whole, if we could change the experience for them, that we might help prevent these situations?
Oh, absolutely. So, you know, let's stick with what we were just talking about with the bullying and the mental health. You know, so you just said that we don't want to profile and we can't profile, but we can deal with some of these underlying conditions. You know, at least in the state that I live in South Carolina, and the state law is that schools have to have some kind of anti-bullying program. So I go and speak to a lot of different schools, maybe an hour long presentation, but me going and talking about bullying for an hour, that should just be the beginning of, you know, a 9 month long, or for you know, schools that have a year long program of bullying intervention. You know, for mental health issues, there should be mental health programs. And part of that should be what, it's a relatively recent field in psychology, which is focusing on psychological mattering. You know, what can we do to increase the likelihood that children and young adults, and adults for that matter, feel like they matter, you know, feel like they belong. We've done some recent research also showing that, you know, feeling that you don't matter is correlated with suicidal ideation and potentially suicidal attempts. So this concept that mattering is important and that belonging is important, you know, and that feeling marginalized puts people at risk for all sorts of things, that's where schools need to devote some of their attention.
I wanted to key in on that idea of mattering, of feeling like people are worth something to other people. How can a school cultivate that kind of feeling in all of their students?
So there's several ways that, and some schools are already doing it. I do want to point that out. There's some schools throughout the country that are already paying attention to this. There are buttons that say you matter, and they'll have, you know, students wear those buttons, or they'll pass them out for anybody that wants to wear them. There's one school in Long Island, and they have each student create like a puzzle piece that, you know, basically, you know, if I were to create my puzzle piece, it would show what makes me unique. And then they put the puzzle pieces together. And what it shows is that, you know, you can't have the entire puzzle without each of the individual pieces, each of the unique pieces that make up the whole. And that makes each person feel special and realize that in spite of the fact that each person is maybe different from another person, or have their own quirks or eccentricities or things that make them, you know, stand out from other people, that, you know, the whole is greater than the sum of its parts. So that's a good example of a way that schools can go about making young people feel like they matter.
You mentioned that mental illness in some cases can correlate with the risk of a school shooting, but not necessarily be the cause. I wonder if, is this a second order thing where if I'm a kid and I'm dealing with a mental health problem, and that is obvious in some way to other students, and they, you know, maybe with meaning to, maybe not exclude me, there's that lack of mattering. There's that isolation that can become a problem.
That's exactly right. And, you know, that makes the person with the underlying psychological problem feel like they don't matter and that they don't belong. And, you know, there's sort of an antecedent and a consequence issue. So it can be the antecedent, but then as a result of, you know, children who maybe have anxiety or depression to begin with may even behave in certain ways that lead them to be marginalized. But then once they sort of distance themselves, then the other children or young people at the school feel like, oh, they're different. I'm not going to, it just becomes this vicious cycle.
With this focus on mattering, on making kids feel like they matter, obviously the percentage of children who end up being involved in these shootings is very, very small. Do we get benefits outside of preventing, say, a school shooting or, as you mentioned, suicide prevention? What are some of the wider benefits of this focus on matter?
Even if we weren't talking about school shootings, everybody can benefit from a focus on mattering. You know, it takes so little to make somebody feel that they're important, to make somebody feel that they matter, just a small act of kindness. You know, I teach an 8 o'clock class every semester, and, you know, these are college kids, and I tell them regularly, more than once a semester, you know, that before we cut, it's a small class, has about 25 students in it. And I tell them that, you know, we have no idea what any of the 26, counting me, 26 of us have gone through before we even walk in that class at 8 o'clock in the morning. And it's just, you know, all it takes is just asking somebody how they're doing or just a small gesture. It takes so little effort to make somebody feel that they matter. And again, without knowing what somebody's going through, that little effort can make all of the difference, whether we're talking about school shootings or just making somebody feel like they belong, or maybe somebody's going through some family situation. But those things also can tie into, you know, we have sort of key, you know, correlates that we know tie into school shootings, but we know that many of the school shooters have also had family problems and, you know, a whole host of other issues that play into it. So again, the mattering, whether we're talking about school shooters or not, the mattering can play into every situation.
We're talking to Robin Kowalski, professor of psychology at Clemson University. She's helping us understand some of the underlying conditions, situations that can lead to school shootings, how we can better identify and address them to prevent more shootings from happening, and, as she's saying, get other benefits for kids. You can join in at 800-642-1234. This idea of making kids feel like they matter at home, in school, is this something you've run into? Have you made an effort to do this as a parent, a grandparent, a teacher, a school counselor, or a fellow student yourself? Are you seeing these kind of ideas in your school? What questions do you have for our guest about how this all works? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. We're picking up our conversation about underlying social and psychological conditions that can make school shootings more likely and how we can prevent them from happening. Robin Kowalski is with us, professor of psychology at Clemson University. She's done a lot of research on this over the years. You can join in with your thoughts, your questions, maybe your experiences at school for you or your kid. Do you feel like there was a good environment where people felt like they belonged? What can make it better? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, experiences, or questions, or email ideas@WPR.org. Robin, hopefully we create these environments where a potential school shooting isn't about to happen. You've also looked, though, at some of the red flags, the warning signs. What can school communities, you know, teachers, parents, fellow students watch out for to suggest that something might be happening in the near future?
Yeah, that's such a good question. So in the vast majority of cases, there are, in fact, warning signs, but so often they're ignored. You know, we often use the phrase leakage to refer to those warning signs. And it could be that maybe the person who ultimately becomes a school shooter has created a video, or maybe they've left a note, or maybe they've written a journal. And again, oftentimes these appear on social media, or maybe they've, on their social media profile, they're posting, you know, images of guns, or, you know, that weren't there, you know, they hadn't been posting like that before. Maybe they're bragging about plans that they have. You know, maybe they're just disclosing to one or two of their you know, acquaintances or friends what they're planning to do. And there's, you know, in schools, oftentimes there's this code of silence where, you know, I've heard this, but I really don't want to say anything. Or maybe other students aren't taking it seriously, but it needs to be taken seriously. But even if it is, maybe there's this fear of, oh, well, you know, maybe I really do believe them, but I'm afraid that, you know, if I tell and they find out that I'm the one that told, you know, maybe I'll be putting myself at risk. So one thing that schools can do is they can make an anonymous reporting system where students who hear something or see something who are afraid to make their identity known can report what they have seen or heard to school administrators without revealing their identity.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Lynn is with us in Mequon. Lynn, hi.
Hi.
What did you want to bring up, Lynn?
Well, it's a wonderful topic to talk about, but what my feeling is, and a lot of these, like that last suggestion is really kind of good, but what I would say is that people that have mental health, and especially kids that have bad situations at home, the teachers can help in that they recognize it. But I think it takes a team of people and a lot of effort. It's nice for kids to say, hi, how are you, and that sort of thing. But kids that are rejected because they're different, they're going to be rejected. And it takes a lot of effort and a lot of thought to help those people. And it probably takes a team of people. And as a former educator, I'll say, number one, it takes a lot of money, but there are no quick fixes. And I think great reporting if you see a kid like that, but expecting kids that are not different to make a difference I don't think it's impossible, but it's pretty hard.
Lynn, thanks for the call. Robin.
Yeah, so I don't disagree that it certainly takes a village. But, you know, I would encourage the caller to watch a TED Talk that's called I Was Almost a School Shooter. It's about Aaron Stark. I would encourage all viewers to watch this TED Talk. It's super powerful. But Aaron Stark talks about he had a horrendous home situation. And he was really suicidal. He had plans to shoot up his school. And he had one friend that reached out to him. And I'm not saying that that's going to, you know, that one friend is going to work for everybody. But at least in that particular case, it did. It's a very, very powerful TED Talk. But I think that the caller makes a good point. It certainly takes, mental health issues are certainly not easily dealt with.
Lynn, thanks a lot for that call. Lynn also brings up a resource question. Do schools have enough resources to devote to, you know, creating that welcoming situation, to providing more help to that kid who needs it?
Well, I think that, you know, one of the things that schools have done, and we want to be careful that we don't exacerbate the mental health issues with some of the attempts we make to intervene, you know, like with lockdown drills and, metal detectors and things like that. And I don't want anybody listening to this to misunderstand what I'm saying. I think all of those things are very beneficial, but there's also a lot of research to suggest that particularly for young kids, like in elementary school, some of those things, particularly lockdown drills, can increase the anxiety of the children. And we also need to remember that most of the time the school shooters are coming from within the school itself. Sometimes they're a former student, like in the case of the St. Louis shooting, but they're going to be, you know, with the drills, the shooter's going to be, they're learning the drill at the same time as everybody else.
Thanks again for that call, Lynn. Robin, if somebody's listening who's involved with their school as an educator, an administrator, school board member, whatever, thinking, yeah, I'd like to do some of the things you're talking about. I'd like to boost this idea of students mattering to one another and to the community. What would you recommend as first steps?
You know, again, there's some schools that have already done it. So one thing I would recommend is that you know, the administrators do a search for schools that are and programs that are already out there that have been very successful in promoting it. Most of these programs are not ones that cost a lot of money, because, you know, you made the point about schools don't have a lot of resources, and so many schools now don't. So the programs that I know about that, you know, have implemented programs related to mattering are not requiring a lot of financial resources, but they seem to be meeting with a lot of success.
And how would those, if people adopt these programs, what does that look like? What kind of things actually happen in a school in just our last minute and a half or so if they adopt one of these mattering programs?
In terms of what they're actually doing or what the effect of it is?
What they're doing, yeah.
Well, you know, just earlier I mentioned like the jigsaw, it's a huge jigsaw and multiple jigsaws where the children are made to not only for the student him or herself, but for everyone to appreciate the uniqueness and the specialness of other students. In another one, in another school, one thing they do is, you know, because everybody's experiences are different, so it's called the Cross the Line Challenge. So they will have students, and they'll start with fairly innocuous questions like, you know, how many of you, I'm just totally making up some of these questions, but, you know, are over the age of 10 or whatever, and then they cross the line. But then the questions get more more detailed and more involved and more personal. You know, how many of you are children from divorced families? You know, because a lot of times when children are struggling with things, particularly at home, you know, they feel like they're the only person who has experienced that, and that they feel like that sets them apart and makes them isolated. But then when they engage in the Cross the Line Challenge, they realize that A, they're not alone, and B, that there's other people, other young people, their peers, that they can talk to about the issues that they're struggling with.
Robin, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's Robin Kowalski, Centennial Professor in the Department of Psychology at Clemson University. She joined us today for a look at ways to address some of the underlying conditions that she's identified as factors that correlate with school shootings and how to create better school environments to hopefully prevent them from happening in the first place. The Wisconsin Republican Party reports that its list of election workers to staff the polls is 3 times longer than it was in 2020. It's a sign of emphasis on election logistics following former President Donald Trump's false claims that the election of 2020 was stolen. As Wisconsin Watch's Jacob Resnick reports, election officials say they're doing their best to reassure voters that the state's upcoming elections will be fair and secure.
Oconto County Clerk Kim Pitleski keeps a series of colorful, hand-drawn posters in her office. On one, she's written in marker, "Perception has become reality." It's a nod to the way election officials like her have come under serious, sometimes ill-informed scrutiny. She wants to reassure people that votes aren't being stolen, despite what they might read on social media.
People are throwing skepticism and these comments out there, but they're not doing the homework on what this really entails.
Frontline election workers are encountering not just questions, but outright hostility. It's fueled by former President Donald Trump's false claims that the 2020 election was stolen. Milwaukee election officials report receiving harassing calls, even death threats, leading officials to beef up security. The Madison metro area is preparing too. In Stoughton, clerks will have trauma kits and training for active shooter scenarios. City Clerk Candy Christian says Dane County had recommended these precautions.
It's a balance between trying to get our poll workers aware, but also not scare them away from being a poll worker.
One part of the Wisconsin Republican Party's response to the 2020 elections has been to invest in what it calls its Election Integrity Unit. In Green Bay, Brown County Republican Chair Jim Fitzgerald says historically, Republicans didn't recruit many poll workers.
When I came into office 4 years ago here, the list of poll workers I had were probably 90% unaffiliated, with very, very few Republicans. That's just the way it was done back then. You know, you try and have identified Republicans, but it wasn't that big a deal.
But it is a big deal now. And it goes back to what the county clerk in Oconto has said. Perception has become reality. Fitzgerald says his party needs to reassure its base angry about Trump's defeat.
The issue has never been the 2020 election with us. It's been as a result of the 2020 election and as a result of how people reacted to it, we have to take care of their reactions.
And it's not just symbolic. Wisconsin election law allows whatever party's presidential or gubernatorial candidate that got the most votes at a precinct to nominate an extra election inspector at that polling place. That extra poll worker could be a tie-breaking vote if there's disagreement over whether to accept an absentee ballot questioned on technical grounds. The Republican Party says it sent 5,053 names to local clerks to work the polls, and that's a threefold increase over 2020. State Democratic officials wouldn't say how many party members they've signed up, but they point to their voter assistance hotline for anyone encountering problems at the polls. And while Republican officials may deny that they're focused on 2020, it's clear that some members of the party are angry about the chaos from voting during the first year of the pandemic. Marge Bostelman was county clerk in Green Lake for 24 years. And since 2019, she's been a Republican member of the Wisconsin Elections Commission. She says her experience as a clerk has guided her votes on the commission, even when it contradicts the party line. Things came to a head last year after she voted with Democrats to allow nursing home residents to vote absentee.
They wanted to make it clear that the Green Lake Republican Party denounced me because of my actions on the WEC.
A year later, the lifelong Republican is unrepentant for her work on the commission.
I'm not going to follow what the party wants me to do if it's detrimental for a municipal clerk to run a fair and honest election.
Back in Oconto, Republican County Clerk Pitt Leske says she's worried about this increasingly winners-take-all mindset in politics.
Because pendulums swing. You know, who's in power, so to speak, that will swing. And we want to write election laws that are in place no matter which political party has the majority, because we all have to play by the same rules on this. Play nice in the sandbox.
Because even in her rural county, political polarization has pitted some neighbors against each other. And she says we can't let our communities be divided this way. For Wisconsin Public Radio, I'm Jacob Resnick in Oconto.